This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Here's a hypothetical situation. It's 3 days to the 2020 presidential election. A video starts circulating on social media. It's shared tens of thousands of times. Your aunt starts texting you to say she can't believe she ever supported this candidate. It might sound something like this.
People love me because I'm a fair person. I'm the fairest person on earth. So Belgium, don't be a hypocrite. Withdraw from the climate agreement. We all know that climate change is fake, just like this video.
Now, what you heard was not President Trump. And no, it was not an actor, for those of you who are thinking Jimmy Fallon or Alec Baldwin. It's a completely fabricated video shared on Facebook last year by a Belgian political party to draw attention to an online petition. It's an example of what's come to be known as a deep fake. The phony Trump ended the clip by saying it was fake, but the stunt was just a little too convincing, and the party had to reassure angry commenters that their eyes and ears had deceived them. The technology behind deep fakes is getting better all the time. U.S. lawmakers are scrambling to counter it ahead of the election. California and Texas have new laws in place, but how do they square with the First Amendment? Joining us now from Davis, California, is Brandy Nanicki, the director of the Citrus Policy Lab at UC Berkeley. Brandy, welcome to 1A.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
Tell us about Citrus Policy Lab. What does it do?
Yeah, the Citrus Policy Lab is headquartered at UC Berkeley, and we support interdisciplinary tech policy research and engagement to better ensure that we support evidence-based policymaking.
Tell us about a deepfake. What is a deepfake, broadly speaking?
Yeah, so a deepfake really is the use of AI to generate deceptive audio or visual media depicting real people saying or doing things that they actually did not.
How does the software work? How do you make, like, if you wanted to make a deepfake of me, how would you do it?
Yeah, so we're going to use some machine learning tools and be able to use different videos of an individual to create something with a superimposed image of you on top of another video where it's seamlessly put together to look like you are actually the individual depicted in the video doing that action.
So you might use, like, I don't know, a clip of me on Meet the Press making a comment, and then you would computer generate another face, like a mask of me over my face?
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right.
How well do deep fakes work these days? I mean, I could kind of tell that was not, it sounded a little bit too much like Jimmy Fallon to really be President Trump. But is that typical? Like, are they really that far off?
They are not that far off, and they're getting better and better and better every day. Soon, I think deep fakes are going to be extremely deceptive. Right now, if anybody checks out that video online, you'll see but the actual video does not look convincing at all, but the audio is pretty convincing.
And we should note, this technology that's used to kind of recreate words, that's not new, to kind of break up words in their component. It's basically what, like, Siri and smart speakers are able to do, right?
Exactly. It's natural language processing.
Now, California's Governor Gavin Newsom recently signed a new law to counter political deepfakes. You've written that the law is well-intentioned, but it's got too many loopholes. What do you think works about that law, and what is the biggest loophole?
Great question. So while I think it's noble in its intent, as you pointed out, I do think that there are errors in the law that will unfortunately make it very ineffective. I think first and foremost, them putting the law in place is a promising step. We're recognizing the threat of deepfakes before an election. But there are some significant flaws. So around timing, right, there's a 60-day limit where it looks at only 60 days before an election. Misplaced responsibility, those actors who are creating deepfakes, including those who are creating malicious deepfakes, are asked to self-identify that content as a malicious deepfake, which obviously is not going to be done by those actors.
Yes, please tell me you're lying to me before you lie to me.
Exactly, okay. Yeah. I'm a con artist. Please sign this waiver before I con you.
Right.
And then also there's a burden of proof to show actual malice in the spread of that content, which can take quite a bit of time to prove. So while that's being deliberated, the video will continue to spread and have negative impacts. And then the final flaw, I think, is around inadequate remedies. So let's say a video went viral, it was spread, it's been debunked as a deep fake, Now what do we do? How do we ensure that those who were exposed to that video then are told later on the veracity of that video?
We should note that deepfakes are not, I think, inherently evil. There are some YouTube channels, for example, that make deepfakes of famous people, and they're entirely marketed as comedy channels, and they are hilarious. Some of them are really crazy funny. And California's law makes an exception for deepfakes that are used for parody, right?
They do, for parody and satire, which I think is incredibly important because this is a technology that can be used for all sorts of different things, like you've said, around comedy. Or think about the movie, the motion picture industry. They use the creation of deepfake videos all of the time in their productions.
With kind of wireframing actors, like, you know, when they make a movie like Avatar, that's the same kind of technology?
Yeah, it is. And then also, for example, you know, in the Star Wars movie, where they bring in actors who have passed away to keep them in the storyline by using old footage of them.
We're speaking to Brandy Nonicke, the director of the Citrus Policy Lab at UC Berkeley. We'll come back to Brandy a little later on, but first let's consider how we got here. After one of Saturday Night Live's many parodies of the president last December, President Trump tweeted that the show, quote, should be tested in courts, unquote. That question's already been asked and answered. In 1983, Hustler magazine published a joke so controversial that the Supreme Court eventually intervened. The court ruled in Hustler magazine versus Jerry Falwell that the First Amendment protects lampooning public officials, even offensively. Joining us here in studio is NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg. She covered the case. Nina, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Joshua.
And also in studio is Mike Volo, one of the hosts of Unprecedented, a podcast about pivotal First Amendment cases. Unprecedented is produced by WAMU, the station that produces 1A. Mike, welcome back.
Thanks, Joshua.
Nina, set the stage for this case. What kind of got the gears in motion?
Well, Hustler magazine published a satire of a very popular ad from that period of time. The ad was about my first time, with the obvious implications, let's put it that way. And it was an ad for Campari, my first time drinking Campari, actually. But you didn't know that till the end of the ad.
So you read all the way down
in the ad. And in this case, it featured Jerry Falwell. And what his first time was, and it was what you would think his first time, you know, the idea of a first time, and it was an extremely lewd and incestuous first time. And Falwell sued Hustler magazine for intentional infliction of emotional distress, and he won a judgment from a jury of $200,000, and Hustler appealed to the Supreme Court. And amazingly, the Supreme Court, by an 8-0 vote, ruled that this was satire and it was protected by the First Amendment. Now, I should note that all the things that you just talked about, telling people this was a satire, actually, in the published version, it did just that. It said, this is a satire not to be taken seriously, or a parody not to be taken seriously. And we'll get to this later, but one of the things about deep fakes is that at the moment you can't sue the Facebook or any other publisher because they're immune under federal law from lawsuit. And there is an argument that that section of the law should be abolished to make these people liable.
Mike, we should note that there's a main character in this other than Larry Flint and Jerry Falwell. There's a guy named Terry Abramson who was at the center of this. Here's how he described what was at stake in this case on this episode of Unprecedented.
How can you censor someone? How can you arbitrarily decide to take a man or a woman's voice? When you take their voice, when you refuse them the opportunity to vent their soul, you are denying their existence. You deny people's humanity when you deny their right to speak their mind.
That's Terry Abramson, and Mike, he's rather rhapsodic about this First Amendment matter. Who is he, and how does he factor into this?
So in putting together this episode, we wanted to tell the story of Hustler v. Falwell, but of course, it's been told. It was told at the Supreme Court. It was told in a book. It was told on film in a movie called The People versus Larry Flint. But one character, one real life person that you won't find in any of those tellings is Terry Abramson. And in some ways, he's the most important person because he's the guy who wrote the parody that got Hustler in trouble. And we found him. He had never been interviewed for a show before. And he's fascinating. He was an advertising guy. He wrote commercials for Starkist and Nine Lives and products like that.
Cat food, like consumer products.
Yeah, for a big ad agency in Chicago. And he got a call from a friend one day who was looking for satire ideas for Hustler. And Terry, because he was an ad guy, thought, well, I'll write some ad parodies. And he went to the newsstand, flipped through Playboy, found this Campari ad with Jill St. John in it, where she was talking about her first time.
She was a Bond girl, right?
She was the Bond girl, Tiffany Case in Diamonds Are Forever. And she is holding up a glass of Campari in this ad, and he thought, this would be a great ad to satire. And he picked Jerry Falwell.
We'll get deeper into the story as we continue with Mike Volo of the podcast Unprecedented, NPR's Nina Totenberg, and Brandi Nonicke of the Citrus Policy Lab at UC Berkeley. We would love your questions and thoughts about this. Maybe you have been fooled by a deep fake. Maybe you've produced a deep fake. What do you think should be done about this new intersection with the First Amendment? 1A@WAMU.org. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you are listening to The Real 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're talking about the Supreme Court case Hustler v. Falwell that established the right to parody and lampoon public figures and what it might mean for us today in the age of social media and deep fake videos. With NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg and Mike Volo, co-host of the podcast Unprecedented, we'd love to hear from you if you have direct experience dealing with this area of the First Amendment. It does protect the right to mock and offend public figures. But should it? Perhaps you've seen certain politicians or public figures that you support lampooned or lambasted in the public sphere, and that rubs you wrong. Or maybe you think there are some people who should definitely be fair game for lampooning, lambasting, or maybe even deep faking. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. Mike, with regard to Terry Abramson, the guy who wrote this ad, this seemed to really affect him on a personal values level. Like, we heard that clip from him. He kind of rhapsodized about the First Amendment. This ran really deep for him.
It did. And I think in part because Terry Abramson was and is a political progressive. And Jerry Falwell was offensive to him. Jerry Falwell was somebody who, and this is the early 1980s now, was anti-gay, what we would now call anti-LGBT. He was anti-ERA. He was anti-pornography.
ERA, the Equal Rights Amendment.
Equal Rights Amendment. He was anti-abortion. And he wasn't just a religious leader. He established this political arm called the Moral Majority. And he had the ear of Ronald Reagan. He was affecting public policy.
And Richard Nixon.
And this was very deeply offensive to somebody like Terry Abramson, who grew up in a progressive household, who sort of believed everything that Jerry Falwell did not. And so when he wanted to come up with an idea for who to parody with this Campari ad, in which people, actresses of the day, were talking about their first time, he thought, I'm going to make it Jerry Falwell, only it's not going to be his first time drinking Campari. It's going to be his first time actually having sex, and it's going to be with his mother in an outhouse.
And was his mother or his grandmother?
Well, so this is my favorite part of the story.
I can't believe I'm asking this question. Oh my God.
This is
your
my
mother
favorite.
Will strike you dead.
No, right. She's probably laughing her head off right now. I know my mother.
The original parody, as Terry wrote it, involved Jerry Falwell, drunk on Campari, losing his virginity to his grandmother in an outhouse. Now, you probably don't want to hold that image in your head for very long, but that's what he came up with.
Thank you for your mercy.
And this was too much even for Larry Flynt, who was apparently very fond of his own grandmother.
So, well, and it went a little farther than that. In the copy, he was like, you know, I figured, and I'm paraphrasing, after the first six guys, I thought, oh, what the
right,
hell?
Right, there was group
like,
sex.
It went really...
There was a farm animal that he had to first kick out of the outhouse. It was pretty out there.
First time I read it, I was like, had I pearls, I would clutch them. Like, this is really intense and over the line, and certainly... Even a toned-down version of this fake ad was too much for Reverend Falwell. Here's a clip of how he reacted to it at the time.
I have never been incensed by a political cartoonist or any other kind of cartoonist other than Mr. Flint when he suggested that as a minister of the gospel that I had been involved incestuously with my late mother who died at age 82 some years earlier, a godly woman, whose memory has never been blemished by anyone.
That was the Reverend Jerry Falwell reacting to this phony ad. Mike?
So, as you heard from that clip, Flint requested that the parody be changed to Jerry Falwell having sex in an outhouse, not with his grandmother, but with his mother instead. Other than that, Flint had no problems with the parody.
Flint, the publisher of Hustler.
The publisher of Hustler,
he was like, let's change a generation.
Exactly.
Nina, talk a little bit about... You know, the time in which this came up. I mean, this was not the first time that Larry Flint had been taken to court. And it seemed like this is one of those cases that begins to lay the groundwork for the way we view the First Amendment today. Like in this modern era where I don't want to say anything goes, but where anything can go somewhere.
So this was 1983. This was a time in which you couldn't say ass on television or radio. I mean, that was considered de trop. You were not supposed to do that. And really, there were, for want of a better expression, I'll say, all of the limits that society had imposed on itself, and, you know, somebody our age may think of in the 1950s, Leave It to Beaver, right? And this parody was so out there. I remember reading it just like you, and going, oh, my God, the Supreme Court is full of some very stuffy people. How are they going to accept this? But I did see the consequences for other parodies if they could limit it. So you can imagine my surprise when, in fact, the most questioning person about this ad and suggesting that it was a legitimate parody at the oral argument was probably the most conservative member of the court at the time, Justice Antonin Scalia, who had a very robust view of the First Amendment, including the idea that people can take almost anything. You just have to tell it to them, and you shouldn't hide stuff from them, and that includes parody.
Let me play a clip from the oral arguments because, as you mentioned, the justice is recognized. Most people would probably find this parody offensive, but they had to draw the line. And that's one of the tough things about ruling on the First Amendment is you have to figure out what's in bounds and out of bounds. Here's an exchange between Justices Antonin Scalia and Sandra Day O'Connor questioning Reverend Falwell's attorney.
Mr. Grubman, you've given us a lot of words to describe this. Outrageous, heinous...
Repulsive and loathsome.
Repulsive and loathsome. Well, I don't know. Maybe you haven't looked at the same political cartoons that I have, but some of them, you know, they and a long tradition of this, not just in this country, back into English history. I mean, politicians depicted as horrible-looking beasts. Can you give us something that the cartoonist or the political figure can adhere to other than such general words as heinous and whatnot?
Yes.
I mean,
I think
does it depend on how ugly the beast is or what?
It's not the amount of hair the beast has or how long his claws may be. I believe that this is a matter of an evolving social sensibility. It is for the jury to decide whether or not what is being depicted is done in so offensive, so awful and so horrible a way that it constitutes the kind of behavior that nobody should have to
put
up with.
Well, Mr. Grutman, in today's world, people don't want to have to take these things to a jury.
Those were Justices Antonin Scalia and Sandra Day O'Connor questioning the Reverend Jerry Falwell's attorney. Nina, that phrase, evolving social sensibility, stuck out to me, partly because that's come up in other cases about the bounds of good taste, like in the obscenity case. Right. It's about an average person applying contemporary standards.
You have to remember that the Supreme Court at this point had been wrestling with how to define obscenity for decades and failing, monumentally failing to the point that they finally just basically gave up without saying so. And the term evolving social standards is not something that Justice Scalia was likely to think was a very good idea.
Jesse commented on our Facebook page, first and foremost, the First Amendment protects dirtbags, and I'm okay with that. Maybe with that, Mike, we should hear an exchange with Larry Flint's lawyer. Here is part of the questioning that he dealt with from Justice Scalia.
The rule you give us says that if you stand for public office or become a public figure in any way, you cannot protect yourself or indeed your mother against a parody of your committing incest with your mother in an outhouse. Now, is that not a value that ought to be protected? Do you think George Washington would have stood for public office if that was the consequence?
Somebody who's going into public life, George Washington is an example. There is a cartoon that has George Washington being led on a donkey, and underneath the caption is something about so-and-so, who was leading the donkey, is leading this ass, or something to that effect.
Now, I can handle that. I think George could handle that. That's a far cry from committing incest with your mother in an outhouse. I mean, there's no line between the two. We can't protect that kind of parody and not protect this.
What you're talking about, Justice Scalia, is a matter of taste. And what we're talking about here is, well, is this tasteful or not tasteful? That's really what you're talking about, because nobody believed that Jerry Falwell was being accused of committing incest. You cross the line when you can say something that can be understood as a false statement of fact.
As part of an exchange between Justice Scalia and Larry Flint's attorney. So what is he getting at here, Mike? What's the argument he's trying to make?
So Alan Isaacman, who, by the way, was played by Ed Norton in the film The People versus Larry Flint, he was trying to help the justices determine when does speech cross the line. And he proposed that it crosses the line when you lie. It's that simple. When you try to pass off as the truth something that is not true and make people believe that. And a parody, said Isaacman, is not a lie. It's a joke. And we recognize that jokes play a vital role in our political culture. They always have, even mean jokes. So he's suggesting if you want to look for a line, don't look at words like heinous or repulsive or outrageous, words that Mr. Grutman, the attorney for Jerry Falwell, was using, because those are going to get you nowhere. They're too subjective. Look at whether or not they were presenting this as a lie. And as Nina said, it was labeled ad parody, not to be taken seriously, and it was listed in the table of contents under fiction.
We're speaking to Mike Volo, the co-host of the podcast Unprecedented, and NPR's Nina Totenberg. We'll love to know your thoughts about where the limits should be. And maybe you've encountered this yourself in terms of your journeys on the internet. Maybe you've gotten fooled by a deep fake or some other kind of a parody or satire online, maybe some link somebody sent you on Facebook, and you've got thoughts about where the First Amendment should come down on this. 1A at WAMU.org, tweet us at 1A, or comment on our Facebook page. Now, Nina, on the flip side of this, I totally understand Justice Scalia's argument. I mean, you put yourself out there as a public figure, yes. But, you know, if someone started making mean parodies about my mother just because I, you know, chose to be on the radio, I'd be highly ticked. And I can understand how Justice Scalia would say, just because you put yourself in line for public scrutiny, does that mean that you also put yourself out for public abuse? And where is the line for abuse?
Well, the court said, you know, if it's a parody, it's protected by the First Amendment. Now, you could argue that some, if you had a parody that was deliberately, what the argument about deep fakes is that nobody knows they're fake. This one was labeled a fake, number one. And you know, this one would have met the qualifications for a malicious falsehood if it had not labeled itself a parody. And where you do it is unimportant. You do it at the bottom of the page. You do it at the end of the video, the deep fake video. But deep fakes today don't do that.
Now, in terms of the, and I just want to make sure, Nina, that we're clear in terms of the path that this took to the Supreme Court. It seemed like, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the earlier judgment where Falwell was awarded cash was based on, you know, infliction of distress and kind of reputational damage. And then by the time it got to the Supreme Court, it was about this larger First Amendment question. Like the bigger issue, I guess, didn't really like come to a head until justices started to weigh the issue.
Well, I don't know whether, you know, at an earlier stage, somebody, a lawyer for Flint, for example, would have moved to have the case thrown out. My assumption is that they did, and they lost. And so this award of cash exists, and now Flint appeals to the Supreme Court. And the interesting thing to me always has been is that, you know, you looked at this ad today, you know, decades later, and you went, ew. And they probably looked at it and went, ew, too. But they unanimously said it was protected by the First Amendment. What their view would have been if there hadn't been some sort of a disclaimer at the bottom. You know, I always say when I'm checking out a story that I've been told with great authority and find out it's not true, I say, oh, another good story ruined by the facts.
Those pesky facts.
Those pesky facts. So, in this case, it was pretty clear to them all. And the opinion was written by then Justice, later to become Chief Justice, William Rehnquist, who maybe was even more conservative than Scalia. But he had a very puckish sense of humor and bawdy sense of humor. And I think also, I'm told that occasionally he used to like to tweak the then Chief Justice Warren Burger with some bawdy joke, then pass it around.
I was just going to ask you whether they personally had an issue with this. And it seems like they were a little more hip than we give them credit for.
Yeah, they were a little more loosey-goosey than we knew.
Right.
At least some of them.
Mike, let me try to get at some of the implications for this now and kind of the larger point of this. Kathleen emailed, just how far into the well of God awful would a person have to go creating a deep fake before getting lower than Trump goes on a daily basis? An outhouse would be a step up for him. Damn. So it's a matter of degree, at least for Kathleen, in terms of, well, yeah, we may have offended you, but if you are basically the guy who gives ammunition for people to say that God hates fags, then you deserve this.
Yeah, and so a couple of points. One, historically, this charge of intentional infliction of emotional distress, this was brought against someone for something they did. It was for an act or a behavior that was considered outrageous and therefore caused emotional harm. And that term outrageous under the law meant beyond all bounds of decency. But here comes Hustler, and now the Supreme Court has to determine whether this charge could be brought against someone for merely speech, in this case, printed speech, the written word. And the justices had a really hard time accepting that speech could be defined with any of those words, especially because Jerry Falwell wasn't just putting himself out there for public scrutiny. He was very outspokenly anti-pornography and anti-Flint. And Flint thought, what I'm doing is answering his charges against me in the pages of my magazine.
Yeah, here's part of how Larry Flint staked out that position.
It's magazines like Hustler that need protection of the First Amendment, not the Washington Post. We offend a lot more people than the Washington Post do. But I think that the First Amendment gives me the right to be offensive.
That's Hustler publisher Larry Flint staking out his position on this case, which we'll dig a little deeper into when we continue with Mike Volo of the podcast Unprecedented and NPR's Nina Totenberg. We'll bring Brandi Nanicki back in from UC Berkeley's Citrus Policy Lab and try to look forward at what this case might tell us about the future. Stay close. Back now to our conversation with NPR's Nina Totenberg and Mike Volo, co-host of Unprecedented. We'd love to hear from you, your questions or thoughts about the way that we deal with deepfakes and offensive content in the light of the First Amendment protections. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A or email 1A at WAMU.org. Let's talk more about the impact of this decision 3 days later, including how to deal with deepfakes. Brandi Nonicke is back with us. She's the director of the Citrus Policy Lab at UC Berkeley. Brandi, earlier this year, a video of the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, was shown. It kind of slowed down to make her speech sound slurred, which something that some of our listeners have mentioned, including Travis, who tweeted, "Don't forget to mention the Nancy Pelosi deepfake that came out this summer and had everyone fooled, including the president." Here is a brief clip from that slowed down version.
"And we thought we had some level of agreement, but you never know with this president of the United States. So that's what happened this morning. It was very, very, very strange."
Now, that was an altered video of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Facebook and other platforms got criticized for not taking it down. What responsibility do you think those platforms have for this kind of content?
Yeah, I'm really happy that the Nancy Pelosi video has been brought up. And I'd just like to clarify that it's actually not a deep fake. So it's not using AI to manipulate the video, but it's what we're calling now either a shallow or a cheap fake. So that's a faked video that's right. been manipulated in some way.
I was just going to ask you about that.
Yeah, that can look more convincing. And quite honestly, I think we should be very concerned about the production of shallow and cheap fakes. They're easy to produce. And like the Nancy Pelosi video, they can be quite convincing.
Why didn't Facebook take it down?
Well, they claimed that it's under protected speech, right? It's there were also discussions about whether or not it was also parody or satire of her, right, where you take a characteristic of an individual and push it to its extremes to make a political point. So perhaps commenting somehow on intellect by slowing down the video.
Nina?
So I am, you know, one of the things about these deep fakes are produced and put online under algorithms and automatically, and as we see in this case, in the cheap fake case, not taken down, even when it is disclosed that they are false. And so, you know, there is this section of federal law that protects online producers like Facebook and others from being sued for libel. But the criterion for libel is that you knowingly do something false, produce something false, and publish something false, and not disclose it in essence, so that people are fooled. And then the people whose reputations are harmed have the ability to challenge you in court and to try to prove that you knew it was false and you published it anyway. And it seems to me that the easy way to deal with that is to require that publishers, and that would include online publishers, once they know something is fake, that they put a line on the bottom that says it's fake.
Mike, it occurs to me that this is kind of an extension of a problem that has existed since the beginning of mass media. I mean, one of the broadcasts that got me into radio was War of the Worlds by Orson Welles in 1938, when the Mercury Theater on the air went on CBS, and when people were flipping channels during a commercial with Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy, they heard this report about Martians landing. Mm-hmm. And at the end of it, Orson Welles does say, you know, that it was a joke. We annihilated the world before your very ears and utterly destroyed the CBS. You'll be relieved to learn, I hope, that we didn't mean it. Right. And both institutions are still open for business. This feels, Mike, to me, like people using the law to beat up on someone who duped them. People don't like to be gullible, but the law is not necessarily your cudgel to beat up on someone who tricked you.
Right. And I think the law as it stands today is not equipped to deal with these deep fakes. And we're really just at the beginning. What scares me is we're really just at the beginning of this technologically. I mean, just imagine this future not too far from now, where, I mean, we're already very skeptical of what we see and read online, and we have to be. But, you know, it seems that there's this future that awaits us where every single thing that we see is just thrown into this kind of kaleidoscopic jumble of truth and fiction, and we don't know what's what. And how do we then make any decisions with that being the reality of the content that we consume?
And how do we sort of have any agreed upon facts? And I do think it's different because these are the first publishers in the history of the country who are not subject to libel and defamation laws. And if there isn't a way of dealing with that, it jumbles together truth and fiction in a way that is unaddressable by those who are harmed. At least Jerry Falwell got his day in court and could say, I didn't have sex with my mother. But that is not always true. I mean, Nancy Pelosi is a very high-level person, but I venture to say that there are still people who view this video and think she was drunk, which was the idea behind it. And it is not that hard to label parody at the end. And as you point out, Orson Welles did that. Other entities that followed that sort of learned, if they were going to do anything like that, to do it often within the product so that people were not freaked out. And, we have at NPR, we have very rigorous ethical standards about how we treat information. And if somebody else is just going to be out there promoting something that is totally false and there's no way for the consumer to understand that, it's a little scary.
Mike?
It's important to note that Jerry Falwell's attorney tried to argue at the time that there were people who might be under the impression that this was his first time having sex with his mother. And even the jury, who awarded him several hundred thousand dollars, said, no, there's just no possible way that anyone's going to believe that this is true. It's so outlandish. It's labeled a parody. We're not buying that argument. We do buy that you were harmed by it, but we're not going to agree that this rises to the level of something that was actually passed off as the truth.
Now, Brandy, contrast that with what we're dealing with online now with people who believe all manner of conspiracy theories. Mm-hmm. I mean, this studio where we're sitting is less than a mile from a pizza place called Comet Ping Pong, where a guy came in with a high-powered weapon and was looking for a basement in the back where Hillary Clinton supposedly had, like, a child sex trafficking ring. A, there was no ring. B, it doesn't have a basement. And C, what the hell? So, Brandy, this kind of feels like it's part of a much larger problem where not only is the web being used to deceive us, it's also being weaponized in ways that can get people hurt.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, one thing that I think that we really need to focus on here, platforms allow for the targeting of these campaigns to go to those people who are most susceptible to be influenced, which is highly problematic.
There even was a there was a Madam Secretary about this very week, in which the idea of this was that there's a big state visit from the president of South Korea and a trade treaty negotiated that is suddenly in jeopardy because there's a deep fake that's online that has the president talking disparagingly about the president of South Korea. And it's a fake. It's a total fake. But it takes a while to unscramble it.
Oh, Brandy, I forgot to ask you. We talked about the legislation in California. Can you tell us more about the legislation in Texas or other legislation that's trying to tackle this problem?
Yeah. So actually, Texas was the first mover. They passed the first law where they are going to restrict the spread of deepfakes 30 days before an election. So we're still having that same issue on timing, right? What about a video that was posted 32 days before an election? Does that fall within the bounds?
What if it's not about an election? What if it's about Joshua Johnson?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, then it's definitely wrong. Do not.
But that's a good point. You don't have to target the actual politician or the candidate running for office, but you could spread deepfakes of other notable figures to influence
Chief Justice John Roberts, for example.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it is not an insignificant issue as it flowers now as a real possibility and not just a science fiction idea. And I do think that eventually the idea of granting total immunity to online publishers is going to get a good look because it's not tied to elections. It's not. It's tied to malicious deep fakes aimed at hurting individuals and defaming them and libeling them.
Mike, did anything about putting this episode together, talking to Terry Abramson, surprise you? Did it change your view on all of this?
Well, you know, I agree with the Supreme Court decision in this case because I think that, you know, this was at a time in the early 80s when it was clear that this was a parody. And certainly, you know, if you believe that the First Amendment protects dirtbags like, you know, one of your listeners suggested, then you might view Larry Flynt as a First Amendment hero. And he paid a pretty steep price for his First Amendment championing. He was in and out of court, as we mentioned, quite a bit. Even before this case, he was shot and paralyzed by a man who did not approve of the depiction of interracial sex in Hustler magazine. And so, I mean, what I struggle with is, and what I wonder, and maybe Brandy could talk about this, is the forensic ability to determine whether or not something is a deep fake keeping up with the ability of people to actually generate deep fakes?
Yeah, Brandy, that's a good question. I mean, AI is used to make this. Is AI also helping catch it?
Yes, exactly. We're using machine learning models to be able to evaluate videos to determine with some level of accuracy whether or not that video is a manipulation. And that research is really moving forward quickly and efficiently. So yes, I think that there are opportunities to apply these new technologies to be able to flag those videos.
How deeply can we go with that? I mean, I imagine we can tell that a video is a deep fake. How far can we go in terms of figuring out what the source of it was or like what part of the world it came from? Is that still farther off?
Yes, that is a lot farther off. I think that is one of the hardest things to deal with is twofold, intent of the video, and then also where did it come from, who created it. Additionally, with all of the legislation that has been put forward, being able to identify the original creator of that content is incredibly difficult. Who is liable when a video is spread like wildfire through platforms across many different actors?
We talked about state laws. Is there any federal effort, Brandy, to try to solve this problem, or are states kind of doing this on their own?
There are federal efforts, but those federal efforts are really being built off of state-level legislation because California and Texas are the only entities that have actually passed laws. At the federal level, they are proposing very similar legislation, banning the spread of deepfakes 60 days before an election. This is an amendment that's put into a federal bill on foreign interference in elections. It's currently under review. There's also a bill proposed to disclose that have people disclose on their deepfakes whether or not it's a manipulation. So again, using that same language that's already appearing in the California legislation.
Nina?
So I have a question. So if Facebook won't take down what they know to be a cheap fake, why would we think that they would take down a deepfake when they know it's a deepfake? I don't know, but has Facebook even labeled the Nancy Pelosi video cheap fake video as a parody? Has it said it's not, you know, is there any sort of a crawl on it?
If I remember correctly, I mean, one thing that they did do, they suppressed its presentation in the news feed. So they have taken some action, right? They can say, well, we didn't remove the video, it's still online, but we are not actively promoting that video.
But they haven't labeled it as something that is not accurate.
I'm not sure if they have or have not. I can't comment.
Jacques in Florida emailed, "We now see all video and trust it until proven otherwise. It needs to be the other way around. It's all fake until proven true. That's the future." Mike, I'd like your reaction to that. I really hope, I understand where Jacques's coming from. I really hope that we don't become quite that afraid and cynical, but I hear where he's coming from.
Yeah, and let me bring this back to Larry Flynt for a moment, because Larry Flynt was an easy target. He was a very outspoken and purist sort of proponent of the First Amendment. He believed with every molecule of his body that a free society meant tolerating speech you don't like. That means vulgar speech, hurtful speech, religious speech, which he didn't particularly like, profane speech, all of it. And so he, and by the way, Hustler had a circulation, a peak circulation of 3 million. That's pretty mainstream. So everybody knew somebody who was reading Hustler, and everybody knew who Larry Flint was. So when this parody came out, you knew where to go. Jerry Falwell didn't go after Terry Abramson. He went after Larry Flint. But with these deep fakes, we don't know where to go. We don't know who to target with our anger.
Brandy, I know we're winding down, but how would you respond to Jacques? Where should people go to try to suss out whether something is real or not? What would you recommend?
So first, I just want to say, when there is no definitive truth, then everything is a lie. And that is highly problematic, because if there is an actual truthful video of a elected leader doing something unethical being spread, people could claim, well, that's a deep fake. It's not true. And then that inserts confusion in the public and a skepticism, which is very dangerous.
Yeah.
What can people do? I think become more informed of the possibility of the spread of deepfakes. I think that there's a significant role that platforms need to play. So within Section 230, their acting in good faith efforts need to be evaluated again.
Brandy Nonicke is the director of the Citrus Policy Lab at UC Berkeley. Brandy, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg. Thanks, Nina.
Thank you.
And Mike Vorlo, co-host of the podcast Unprecedented. You can find this and other episodes wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks, Mike.
Thanks so much, Josh.
This conversation was produced by Orion Donovan Smith. To learn more about him and the rest of our team, visit the1a.org. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. And what you just heard was the real thing. This is 1A.